Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, what white kids and their parents say and believe about race. Sociologist Margaret Hagerman spent 2 years listening as white middle schoolers talked about race, why their black schoolmates were picked on by the teacher, why no one liked the only two black girls in their school, why it hurt to be called a racist. She also talked and listened to their parents, and that was eye-opening, too. The result is a new book that explores how kids come to their understanding about race, how their schools and sports and interactions with their parents shape that understanding. Professor Hagerman writes in the introduction, how white affluent children make sense of race not only reflects but also reproduces and reinforces the existing racial order. As Maggie Hagerman joins us, I know we'd both like to hear from parents in the audience this morning. Are you aware of the interactions and the opinions that your preteen kids have about race? What happened the last time you talked directly about racial divisions with your kids? Are those conversations you ever have? So as we begin the discussion, parents, I'd like to hear from you this morning. How aware are you of the interactions and the opinions that your middle school age, your preteen kids have about race and racial bias? What happens when you bring it up? Do you ever talk directly to your kids about it? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, wherever you are in our five-state region. And if you're hanging out with me on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Margaret Hagerman is a sociologist at the University of Mississippi. The new book is titled White Kids Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. And she's with us today from Starkville, Mississippi. And Maggie, welcome. We've rescheduled this a couple times. I'm so glad you were patient with us and that we could get this going. So thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
If I was to deconstruct that quote that I took from your introduction, it sounds to me like you're saying that unless we're more cognizant of how the next generation of white Americans are understanding race, the divisions that we see today are going to continue. What would you add to that?
Well, I think that's a great way to put it. And yeah, I think that the ideas that support a system, and I'm a sociologist, so I'm very interested in sort of thinking about our society as a system, how those systems stay in place, you know, these ideas support those systems. And so my research is really trying to explore how ideas about race form in our newest generation of young white people.
You know, what I want listeners early on in the discussion to understand here is not, oh, you know, these kids were constantly spouting out racist ideas and epithets and that kind of thing, and their parents were appalled at that. It's nowhere near as overt as that. It's the signals and the overheard conversations that kids are picking up on that I think parents are often not even aware that they are. Is that fair to say?
I think so. And certainly that's what I found in my research. I think it's really important to note, in addition to what you just said, that none of the parents in my research, and I talked to quite a few of them, there's 30 families total that participated. None of these families told me that they wanted to raise a child bigoted or racist or anything like that. So, yeah, I mean, these I sort of try to document the more subtle ways and implicit ways that young people are interpreting the social world around them and how those interpretations are leading them to come up with ideas that I think sometimes go against the very things that their parents are hoping that they'll develop.
What's clear to me is you saw something that I think is even and that I draw from your book that's even more troublesome and stubborn, and that's kind of the lack of examination, right, about race, just that we don't, you know, we're not a family that says mean things about people of other races. We don't see color. I think somebody, one of the parents told you that. This is really how privilege gets reinforced without a lot of examination, isn't it?
I think so. And certainly, I think a lot of the parents in the book who told me that they did not want to talk about race with their children, or that they didn't examine sort of race or racial privilege, or even inequality, you know, their kids were still developing ideas about race. I mean, they live in a country that is, as I argue, divided by race in many ways, but is also a country that's structured by race. And so, you know, we have all kinds of patterns in our society at the structural level that kids notice. They notice that the, you know, makeup of the Senate and the makeup of NBA basketball teams, you know, from a perspective of race. And so, you know, to think that kids are somehow not noticing these things, I think is a little bit misguided, at least based on my research.
You say at one point, these parents do not believe their children even think about race. And when you would tell the parents, hey, I overheard your kids talking about this and that and this, they were surprised, weren't they?
Absolutely. I do think it's important to note that there were different groups of parents. So certainly some of the parents did not talk about race and did not think that their children had anything to say about race. But there were other parents that were more open and actually incorporated a more direct approach to talking about race with their children. But yeah, for that first group, you know, they were always very curious about what their kids had said to me, which I thought was interesting. But for the most part, they were surprised to learn that their children had these ideas.
Let me grab a call here from Michelle in Minneapolis. Hey, Michelle, hi. How does this work in your household?
So we actually have younger children. They're 4 and almost 7. But it was something like I wanted them to have a literacy on race and racism as early as possible. So we went to a class. We've read a book. And we just have very open conversations. My older son goes to a very integrated school. And we just openly name, you know, with the younger one, we kind of started with, like, these are different skin colors. People are born, you know, like kind of more basic stuff, but we just talk about it because I want them to be able to name it. And I know they're having thoughts about it anyway. So I want them to know it's a comfortable space to bring up questions or thoughts or observations, and then we can talk about it.
Michelle, do you ever hear your kids, 4 and 6, right? Is that what you said? Do you ever hear them talking to each other or talking with their friends about race, and you kind of eavesdrop to hear how they're processing this?
In terms of what I hear them say, it's more just at a descriptor level. Like they might say that child, you know, has black skin, or that child speaks Somali or something. But right now it seems like it's on a description level.
Does that sound, Maggie, like what you experienced when you were talking to kids and observing these families?
Well, certainly most of the kids in my study are a little bit older than Michelle's kids, but certainly from the developmental literature and other researchers, I think exactly what she was kind of talking about with descriptors, that's very common for young children who are trying to, you know, they're sorting things, they're learning about, you know, how to describe the world around them, they're noticing things. So I do think that there's some research that really goes along with exactly that experience.
Are you there, Maggie? Hi.
Yeah. Hey.
Sorry, we're having a few technical things here. Is it fair to say that parents are communicating ideas about race to their kids in a lot of different ways than what they say? So, you know, which neighborhood that they're saying is safe to walk through, the school that they choose and why they like that school, you know, which kid's house is okay to go to after school. That probably to many parents does not sound like a direct conversation about race, but it's communicating a wealth of information, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the most powerful places, really, I think, in my research, to notice this happening is when you're driving kids in the car and they're in the back seat. So one of the things I did in my research is for some of the families, I provided childcare. And so certainly I witnessed, you know, these kids looking out the window and noticing people that they saw and making comments. And, you know, these are ideas that they are sort of interpreting as a result of the social environments that they are within. So if their parents make decisions about about raising their children in a, you know, white bubble, so to speak, you know, that leads to different understandings about the world than if you raise children in an environment that's more racially, you know, meaningfully racially integrated or so forth. So I absolutely think that, you know, actions speak louder than words. You know, the choices that parents make about the social environments that their children are living their childhoods in, you know, really matters for the ways that the kids see the world.
If you've just tuned in to the conversation this hour, we're talking with sociologist Margaret Hagerman. You'll hear a few little technical glitches. We're trying to work that out. Bear with us because this is a really interesting conversation. I've been looking forward to it. She's a sociologist at the University of Mississippi, and she has a new book called White Kids Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. And one of the things she did to research the book was to just listen to kids interacting, white kids interacting with other white kids, and what they said about race in their classrooms and classmates and the school and the places they were allowed to go. She also talked to parents who, many of whom told her that they did not really have direct conversations about race, many of whom, not all. But what becomes clear in the book is that parents signal and communicate a lot of information about their own racial opinions in the way that they talk within the household and the decisions that they make. So I'm interested this morning if you're aware of the interactions and the opinions that your middle school age kids or younger have about race, whether they ever talk about racial bias in a way, you know, that seems appropriate for their age. And what happened the last time you actually had a conversation with your kids in your family about race and racial bias? 651-227-6000 on Twitter at @CarrieNPR, where Heather says, "I purposely put my child in a diverse school. We discuss race often. We ask our friends of other races how we can do better. We're always learning and want to be the best allies that we can be." 800-242-2828 in our region. To Monique in St. Paul. Hey, Monique. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Glad you called.
Yeah. So I wanted to call and say, so I'm not a parent. I'm 24. And I grew up in a white, affluent Catholic family, but my parents chose to send me to a diverse public school for grade school. And then for high school, I went to a Catholic private high school and then attended a Catholic university for college. And I really appreciated the diversity that I experienced in grade school. But to me then, it didn't really hit me the diversity, how much I appreciated it until I attended those Catholic institutions. And I personally wished that my parents had sat me down and explained to me the color of my skin did not mean that I was superior in any way to those who had different skin tones. And I, you know, I never, it, so anyways, I wish that my parents, we just missed the mark on talking about race.
And Monique, I think your experience, you know, fits with a lot of what Maggie observed. Maggie, what do you hear in that?
Well, it's funny. It actually reminds me of one of the children in my study who sort of had the same comment. He was going to a private school for middle school, and he was very concerned about the fact that the only other kids at his school, for the most part, were also white and were also, you know, quite affluent. And he actually, you know, sort of talked to his parents about this and was like, you know, why can't I go to the public school? You know, I don't think that this, you know, school is really teaching me all the things that I want to learn. You know, I want to learn about different people and interacting across different, you know, social divisions and all of this. And so, you know, he was certainly, I think, unusual from the sample. But I do think that sort of some of the things that Monique was just saying, you know, certainly relate to that child's experience and that desire to be in spaces that are beyond just the sort of, you know, homogenous white privileged community.
Maggie, was that Greg and Connor? Greg the parent, Connor the son, because I think Connor he's got a somewhat advanced understanding about race and racial bias. And Greg, the parent, is kind of saying, I know we could do more. I'm, you know, in some ways, I'm kind of figuring this out in real time, and I'm open to what Connor's bringing back. Is that the father and son you're talking about?
It's actually a different kid, but yes, there's some similar dynamics there too. So the thing with Connor is that Connor has always gone to public schools, and his parents purposefully chose to live kind of like some of the other callers and people on Twitter have mentioned, you know, purposefully chose to send their children to a meaningfully integrated public school. But even in that family, you know, that dad is talking very openly with Connor in front of me about how even still, you know, there's work to be done, and there's problems even in that public school, especially in high school, with tracking and, you know, the ways in which white children or white teenagers are put into the honors and AP classes and the black kids are not, you know. So I think that there's someone mentioned recently that just called in, I think, or maybe you were reading it, that, you know, the work doesn't end, you know, that people still have to keep trying. And I think that that's true. Just sending your kids to an integrated school is not going to necessarily mean, you know, the work is done.
A call here from Alex in Minneapolis. Hey, Alex, how does this work in your household?
Good. Yeah, we're in a white affluent household on East Harriet, mm-hmm. in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And our school district, just by default, is a very integrated school. It's about a third Somali, a third Hispanic, and a third white. And at first, I was a little nervous about it. I thought, is he going to be like a token child in maybe one of his classrooms? Sorry, I'm a little nervous here.
It's okay.
Yeah, on the air. But really, the more it's gone on, I have an 8-year-old now in second grade, and then a 4-year-old in high five.
Mm-hmm.
And it really seems like, you know, the more you see people as people, as individuals, as regular people, then it's harder to write off whole groups as other, as them. And I think getting daily exposure has been really nice.
So do you talk to your son about what's it like to be one of the fewer white kids in the class? I mean, how direct are the discussions you're having about this experience that he's having every day?
I mean, it hasn't really come up too much, but recently I had to talk to him about the whole Black Lives Matter movement.
Uh-huh.
He's seen signs up around and was asking about that, and I thought, well, this is pretty heavy. But I talked to him about it, and I talked to him about, you know, the history and the privilege that he does have. And he seemed to be kind of distressed, you know, by at least how I laid it out for him. And I think that was good. I mean, it's obviously something he thought about. And then later I actually heard him talking to some friends about it. Like, do you know that if you have darker skin that, you know, the police can treat you differently?
Huh.
And I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Alex, I'm really glad you called. You got over the nerves there a little bit. Good to hear the experience. Maggie, one of the things that you say that parents can do is find the language to talk about this within the household. And I hear Alex saying it doesn't come up that much. Advice for him, perhaps, on how to bring it up, or is that not necessary, given what's going on there with his son?
Well, I think what's really great, actually, about Alex's example is that his child asked him a question about seeing, you know, the Black Lives Matter signs, and then he engaged in a thoughtful conversation and dialogue with his son. And that's actually, I think, in my experience, at least with my research, unusual, because typically what we see is it's in the aftermath of a racist hate crime or something that suddenly there's this call for people to talk to their white kids about race. And I actually think that, you know, a better strategy would be to have, you know, everyday kinds of conversations about race when things happen, you know, when things come up, just sort of in everyday life, like noticing a sign, as opposed to waiting until there is a moment of crisis and then not having any foundational, you know, work in place, so that then the child is really sort of confused or overwhelmed. So I also think it's really important to note that while parents, you know, who are white might feel like it's like stressful or it's difficult to find the right words, talk about race with their children, I think that's also a manifestation of privilege, right? That there, meanwhile, there are families who are raising, you know, African American children, children who are recent immigrants, and so forth, who feel like they have to have these conversations with their kids. So, I guess I just want to encourage Alex, and everything that he said, I think is really great.
From Twitter here, we discuss race, but our choices speak louder than words. We chose Spanish immersion for our kids, put our son in a neighborhood school that is 30% white, make sure that we see movies like Hidden Figures, and the majority of our books feature minority leads. My 3-year-old granddaughter, says Sarah, was talking about the Mean Black Girls. Turns out the Mean Girl characters in Purplicious wear black clothing. Troubling. And to the phones here to Wesley in Rochester. Hey, Wesley. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you.
What's your experience with this?
So my wife and I are both affluent white individuals, and we've adopted 2 children from foster care here in Rochester, both of African-American descent.
Mm-hmm.
And I can attest to that white privilege is something that we don't even think about as white parents,
mm-hmm.
until, you know, it's forced on you every single day. And yeah, I have to talk to my kids about these things every day. And I'm just shocked how much I have to discuss with them on a regular basis just to feel like I keep them safe.
Can you give me an example of the last time you felt like you had to have a conversation with your kids about it because of what happened?
We're pretty generous with them with regard to conversations. If they ask questions, we always answer.
Mm-hmm.
If they have follow-up questions, we answer those as well until they stop asking questions. But, you know, slavery comes up. Why was this kid walking through Minneapolis arrested for just, you know, crossing the street? You know, we even talk to them about Sandra Bland, you know, and how to interact with the police. In these situations, you know, you just say yes, sir, no, sir, and you don't do anything else, and you let me handle it.
No. Maggie, curious about what you hear with what Wesley and his wife are having to say to their kids.
Yeah, I mean, this is the reality for people raising children of color, and particularly black kids in America. I mean, there's actually some really great scholarship on this topic and sort of survey research with parents, as well as some more interview-based projects. There's some really powerful data about how parents were talking to their kids, particularly their black children, about the death of Trayvon Martin, the murder of Trayvon Martin, the murder of Michael Brown. I mean, there's some research, you know, sometimes our research takes a minute to catch up with what's happening in the news, but certainly we know that there's scholarship that's documenting exactly some of the dynamics that he was just mentioning.
I'm remembering the discussions I think you had with Holly, which were pretty instructive. She's a parent, one of the families that you talked to in researching the book, and you ask her if she and her husband talk about the fact that their child's school is so white, and she says this to you: "No, we don't talk about it. It's, you know, it's a non-issue for us. I would welcome more people of color, but I just want everyone who is here to be on the same page as all the parents like me." As a sociologist, what are you picking up there?
So as a sociologist, I'm picking up that she's really talking in racially coded language. She's saying that she doesn't mind if, you know, black people from the city move to the suburb where she lives. She's not using that language exactly, but that's basically what she's getting at. If they value education, and the insinuation there is that black people don't value education, and certainly that is not true. In fact, there's a generous amount of research that shows that actually parents who are raising black children might even in some studies care more about their child's education and give their children tools to navigate not only their school but also racism at their school. And that's, you know, and this is another way to measure the ways that parents, black parents, are caring about their children and their children's education. And so, yeah, I think that that Holly is suggesting that the reason that her community is white is because people that are white value education, and that's sending a message to her children. Her children are perceiving that people like me care about education, and when I look around my classroom, everyone's white, so white people must care about education. And that's certainly some of the ideas that the kids were sharing with me.
Marcus says on Twitter, "I grew up in a purely white society where making jokes about gay people was common. It fills me with pride that our kids have friends of different races and sexual orientation. I feel that I learned at least as much from my kids as they learned from us." To Heidi in Minneapolis. Heidi, how does this work in your family?
Well, my kids were lucky to go to the Minneapolis public schools in a really racially diverse environment, about a third black, a third Asian, a third white. And when my daughter was in middle school, she was playing on a traveling basketball team, predominantly black, and she was playing with a hot game, mm-hmm. and fifth grader, and she got into it with a little girl, another girl, and she yelled, you know, she insulted her and said she had nappy hair, and the judge, the referee called a technical, and I went up to the ref and I said, you know, that was an insult, yes, but you know, she goes to a predominantly black school, and when somebody's hair is messy, they call it nappy, and I don't think she even knows that there's a racial bias in that, and she was just being a middle school girl insulting another middle school girl, and the ref, who was black, just smiled and laughed and said, I think you're right. And what happened, though, is that when she was very young, you know, that age, there was a sense, there wasn't a big division. They were all us. But the big advantage that she had in her adult life now, in high school and then later in adult life, is that she has this awareness. She had this usness, and then she had this awareness. And then she became aware of her white privilege.
Heidi,
she's very active.
If I might, I think your intervention is a pretty interesting part of that story. And I'm curious about how Maggie hears that.
Well, I certainly think that, you know, having direct conversations and, you know, answering children's questions and sort of helping kids figure out, you know, even how to talk about race, right, in sort of ways that are respectful of each other and in ways that, you know, convey the true meaning of what they're trying to convey or whatever. I think that's really important. And so I think, you know, one of the things I noticed with the kids in my study is that many of them who were being raised in community, in a family and community that did not talk about race, had a tremendous number of questions and anxieties and concerns about, you know, even just how to, like, literally talk, like the words to use. So I think that parents having more explicit conversations about that is good.
Do you, Heidi, are you still there?
Yeah.
Do you look back and think, maybe I should have just let that, maybe I should have let my daughter take the technical for using a word that she knew was in some way insulting, and maybe that was the more powerful lesson than you intervening to say, no, what she really meant to say was this. Do you see why I'm asking?
Well, it may be. It may be. I hadn't thought about it that way, but that's a good point.
I'm really glad you called. You've given us a good conversation point. Thank you. Maggie Hagerman with us. She's a sociologist at the University of Mississippi, and she's the author of the new book, White Kids, Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. Really great to hear your experiences with this. Whether you talk about race pretty openly, racial bias in your family, whether you overhear your kids talking about it and are trying to figure out, how do I find the language to talk to kids today about what's happening on racial bias in America. Is this something that you've hesitated to bring up? Are you looking for some, I don't know, information and advice about how to have a more flourishing conversation about racial bias? Margaret Hagerman has some good ideas about that as well. Maggie, I'm going to go right back to the phones. We have so many people who want to get in on this. Rob in Redwood, Minnesota. Hey, Rob, thank you for waiting. You're a teacher, is that right?
Yes, that's right. I teach middle school.
Tell me what you're thinking as you've heard the discussion develop.
Well, I'm also a parent and now of middle school age kids, but throughout the years I've thought of, you know, I come from a predominantly white background and I teach in a school that's becoming more diverse. But one question, one observation I've made over the years is, I don't remember exactly how or why it started, but I got to the point where I realized kids were so uncomfortable talking about race. So I started posing it as a question, like true, false, or yes, no, just to the kids. Mm-hmm. Is it okay to talk about race or issues about race in school? And I've been blown away in a bad way about how so many kids answer no.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know, but I try to, you know, encourage them to think that I don't agree with that, and that I think it's very important that we do, and that it's not only okay, but it's very important that we do try to talk about race and become educated on issues of race. But it's an observation I've made that kids are very, generally speaking, not all of them, but it seems like a majority answer no to that and say that it's not okay, like it's too, it's like it's taboo or it's too scary of a topic.
Maggie, what do you think's going on there?
Well, certainly I found a similar pattern in my research. In fact, one of the things that I did to try to make kids feel more comfortable talking about race was to show them different pictures of celebrities and to use that as a strategy to get them, you know, to sort of, you know, tell me who your favorite celebrity is. And then I would ask, can you tell me what, you know, race these different celebrities are? And again, I was just using it as a way to sort of, you know, warm up, you know, get the kids feeling comfortable. But some of the children actually said, no, I don't want to tell you what race these people are because that's racist. Like talking about somebody's race is racist. And that was the message that they were being, you know, sort of taught by their families and their schools, that any discussion of race is racist and therefore we don't talk about it. And certainly there was even a school actually that had a rule that if you used the word racist as an insult or even talked about racism, that was breaking the school rules. And I asked the little girl who told me this, like, well, what happens if someone at your school is like actually doing something that you think is racist? And she's like, oh, well, that would never happen at our school because people aren't racist at our school. And so it's like they literally didn't even have the language. They weren't allowed to use the language to even identify racism, let alone have a more meaningful conversation like the one that the caller just mentioned.
I also kind of concluded from the conversations you were having with parents for the book that parents have some pretty shallow discussions about this where they say things like, well, it's about exposing my children to different foods or different music, you know, kind of nibbling around the edges of a more direct discussion about race. And you say, however well-meaning parents may be, when they fail to acknowledge inequality and racism in a way, they are unintentionally complicit in the reproduction of it. I bet of course those parents would be appalled by the idea of that. But what are you saying?
So again, I have three different groups of families in the study, and this families that fit into this category are families that say that they really value diversity. They say that they care about multiculturalism, but then they make decisions like sending their kids to private school or sending their kids to the public school, but then advocating for them to be in certain classrooms that are predominantly white. And so for these parents, their understanding of, you know, raising race-conscious children is about celebrating diversity and celebrating multiculturalism. And like you said, you know, going to festivals where there's different foods from across the world and sort of celebrating different practices and languages. And while that's all wonderful, you know, that's not addressing power and privilege and inequality and oppression and history and white supremacy and all of these things that, you know, I think based on my research are actually, you know, topics that really can help children think more critically about race and racism from a position of structural privilege. And so, you know, scholars talk about this. Joyce Bell, one of my colleagues, talks a lot about diversity discourse. And there's this concept of shallow multiculturalism, you know, that, you know, just talking about how we're all different and celebrating that, that doesn't really address the underlying inequality.
From a listener in the Crocus Hill neighborhood, which is a neighborhood of St. Paul, Maggie, she writes, the moms in my neighborhood all have Black Lives Matter signs, I assume, in their yards. But then they will send out an email saying, there's some black kids out fundraising. Don't give them any money. We don't want to encourage them. And she adds, sums up liberal Minnesota and race. To the phones to Daniel in Champlin, Minnesota. Hey, Daniel, hi.
Hi. So I'm 22 years old. I'm not a parent, but I've had a bit of a unique upbringing with race.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my parents are white, but I grew up going to Champlin Park, which bordered right on Champlin and Brooklyn Park. Champlin was about 95% upper class white, and Brooklyn Park was a much more diverse and lower income. So my parents never really talked about race a ton, but my parents also grew up low income, so they really like tried to say fairness was like the number one most important thing. So that just kind of came naturally to me. But in high school over at Champlin Park, we really learned about feminism in English class and mm-hmm. race. And that was like the primary point of discussion there. And then what was really interesting was Champlain Park was it was pretty clicky. You'd have groups that didn't really interact with each other. You had like the rallies where nobody was really excited. Then for the last semester of my senior year, I actually moved down to Illinois and went to a high school that was about 80% Hispanic, where I was actually the minority. And so what was interesting about that was the whole idea of feminism and racism being taught in English class, it wasn't even brought up. Feminism was one of the six lenses that we would view English literature through. And the teacher wasn't even necessarily feminist, but she was definitely for women's rights. And then with that, too, even going to the rallies, nobody was clicky there. There was a much stronger sense of community, even though everyone was lower income. And everybody got really excited for the rallies. And it was just an interesting cultural shift. I know it's not so much to do with the discussion of how did the parents influence it. But I've also heard from Professor Russell Barkley that, you know, as children get older, and as they go through middle school and high school, that the influence of parents that they have on your children is less so than the neighborhood and the community that they grow up with. So I guess I wanted to hear the perspective on it.
Yeah, Maggie, what about that?
Yeah, so actually, one of the things that I find in my book is that peers play a huge role in shaping, you know, these kids' ideas about race, particularly for kids who are growing up with parents who for them, that subject is off limits. And so I observed a lot of moments when children would try to figure out things by talking to their peers. Like, I observed two boys having a discussion about why there were more black basketball players in the NBA than white players, and they were debating this back and forth while they were eating string cheese and, you know, kind of just sitting around. But their conclusion was that, oh, this is because black people have an extra muscle in their leg. And, you know, that was what these guys concluded. In large part, I think, because they have no one is guiding their discussions. And certainly that whole concept of like anatomical differences between the races is rooted in scientific racism. So certainly they're learning about these kind of cultural ideas and myths from someplace. But it was interesting to watch kids together, kind of like the caller just mentioned, like trying to figure out race and racism, and or even just, you know, difference, human difference, especially in families where their parents did not want to talk about it.
I think it's clear, as you describe some of your interactions with the kids, that there are, you did encounter kids who are thinking more deeply about racism and advantage and the privilege of having white skin. But you suggest, and I think you've just hit on this, that that's where it ends because the parents or teachers or whatever don't step in to guide the discussion further. So it seemed like there was an interest on the part of kids to take it further. And maybe what? Parents who weren't sure how to do that? Teachers who shy away from it? What do you think?
Well, I think there's a lot of, you know, very nuanced and complex. There's lots of different families and different schools and teachers and all that in the study. But I certainly think that there were moments where parents were being challenged by their kids. And this happened in multiple different directions. But one of the powerful moments that I remember when I was doing my data collection was I asked a girl if she had ever experienced racism. And she started to give me an example of that. And her mother interrupted her and said, "Oh, honey, that's not racism." And she, you know, the girl stormed off to the bathroom. And, you know, I got to witness lots of family fights as part of this project, which was interesting. Bet. But it was, what was interesting is that later I talked to the girl by herself and she said, "You know, sometimes my mom is racist and she doesn't like to talk about this stuff, but I think she needs to," you know. And so this was a girl who was challenging her mother in that moment, but also other moments, and sort of pushing her mother. And I saw examples of kids talking about pushing their teachers. One guy who would read the newspaper every morning before school so that he could go and argue with his teacher about current events. So kids have agency, and you know, while certainly it's complicated, I do think that the children in my study were for the most part, you know, enacting that agency and sort of, you know, at least for some of them, demanding more from the adults in their lives.
I think this is an example of this. Chris in Brainerd called to say, "My son came home from school and brought up the fact that other kids were talking about races in a derogatory way. He asked us why kids thought that way. And then we had a good conversation about race with them," to Amanda in Orono. Hi, Amanda.
Hi there.
Glad you waited.
This is my first time calling in.
Oh, I'm glad you did. Sorry it took so long to get to you, but I'm intrigued with what you're going to say. What do you want to add?
Well, so my husband is 45, so he was going through grade school, you know, in the early 80s and such, and he grew up in San Diego. And at the time, I think it's a little bit more segregated in terms of affluent neighborhoods now. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it was really a big melting pot. And as a white kid, he, according to him, I haven't fact checked this, but he was in the minority. And he said it was a very, very stressful situation being there in the public schools. He said he got very street smart very early. He did his best to avoid confrontation, to avoid fights, to avoid looking at kids the wrong way. And he has red hair. So he said his perception is that he got picked on a little bit more than maybe his other white peers. But he just grew up scared. Mm-hmm. And kind of threw his heart into basketball and sports and things like that. And then his junior and senior year, he was lucky enough to shouldn't use the word lucky, but he got sent to a private school because things were just a little too stressful for him. So fast forward now, we have two young kids, 6 and 4. Mm-hmm. We're in Orono, of which there is no diversity here at all.
Right.
And
upscale, part of a suburb of Minneapolis, just so Maggie knows. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, and he was driving it so that our kids didn't have to grow up the same way that he did, because he had so much fear. And mm-hmm. he's also been, he was attacked by two fellow black basketball players in his dorm room when he was in college. So he had just a couple, he had a lot of stuff over the course of his life. And I don't fault him for wanting to put our kids here, but it does worry me for the whole, you know, reason for this book is even if we do have conversations, and as your guest suggests, you know, try to expose them to diversity, racism, other cultural aspects, does it all fall so horribly short?
Oh.
Because we are where we are in the school district that we're in and the neighborhood that we're in.
I don't know.
I wonder if all of our efforts or my driven efforts will just be for naught.
Well, I'm glad you gave us a little bit of the background. So here's two parents, Maggie, coming with different experiences and maybe different views about where their kids should go to school and how they should experience those schools. So what do you think?
Well, you know, I can't give anyone advice or anything. I think, though, try to be thoughtful about, you know, I heard a lot of like sort of, you know, growing up in fear, feelings of fear. And I guess I just sort of would push back a little bit and think about, you know, who are the kids in America who are growing up in fear, you know, generally, like we're looking at a structural kind of patterns kind of level, you know, and certainly I'm not trying to deny anyone's personal experience. But, you know, I think that when, as a sociologist, you know, when I'm looking out at the world and looking at patterns, you know, the kids that are growing up in fear are the kids who, you know, are worried that they're not going to, you know, they might get, you know, shot by the police, or they might get, you know, hauled off by ICE, or they might, you know, live in a community that doesn't have, you know, the kinds of resources that they need to thrive. And so I think that, again, you know, I don't want to give people advice or speak to anyone's, you know, I'm not trying to deny anyone's personal experience. But, you know, again, I think that there are some broader structural arrangements that we should look at as a society and try to think about the best way to navigate those, not only for our own children, but also for all of the children.
A guest or a listener on Twitter says, I'm an Indian immigrant married to a white American man with a 3-year-old biracial daughter. We chose to live in the city and send her to Spanish immersion. Curious to know, how do I help my biracial daughter and my mostly white social circle be more woke about race today? Well, you start with ordering a copy of Maggie's book, White Kids, Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. But you have a couple... You have some tips here at the very end of the book. What would you share on that, Maggie?
Well, I should first say that just for all of your listeners, that there's a really great website called Embrace Race, and they have all kinds of resources that span across different racial groups, so sort of racial socialization in general, resources for parents raising children of various different racial groups, so that, you know, that I think that's a really great resource. And there's all kinds of psychologists and child development folks and people giving advice, and that's a real concrete kind of form of advice. But from my perspective as a sociologist, one of the things that I sort of noticed in my research is what I refer to as the conundrum of privilege. And that is that on the one hand, many of the parents I spoke to believed that they, you know, wanted to raise their kids to be anti-racist, to be race conscious, to value equal opportunity and, you know, justice and so forth. But on the other hand, they also wanted to be a quote unquote good parent. And for many people, that meant giving their children all of the advantages that their resources could provide. And so these parents found themselves in this sort of paradoxical situation in which they wanted to raise anti-racist kids, but they also wanted to give their kids all of these unearned advantages. And so, you know, that's sort of this moment that I think is a moment of potential intervention for the future, and thinking about how parents navigate that and how they navigate the everyday decisions that they make, that, you know, even if they say that they care about, you know, reducing racism or challenging racism, you know, how is their behavior actually reinforcing the very thing that they say they reject?
All right. And how are they talking about that behavior and those decisions? Like why
Absolutely.
We chose the school that we chose. Call here from Tony in South St. Paul. Hi, Tony.
How are you doing?
Doing good.
Hi, Maggie. So my question, I'm going to keep it short, is the media uses race in a way to separate and compare us when there's so many other factors that comprise us as individuals. And it kind of bothers me. I'll say I'm a short white male. So I'm a white male in the eyes of all of the news outlets, but if they were to put on polls, 50% of males under 5'5" vote this way and above 5'5" vote this way, I would look at that as ridiculous, just kind of how I look at the 50% of black individuals vote this way versus Hispanic. It just,
so Tony, like just so I can give that. Maggie a little bit of, are you saying why is everything about race?
When we're trying to make everybody on one playing field to some extent,
okay,
why do we want to still separate it among a color when there's so much more to those individuals
okay.
in their socioeconomic
status? I think we've got it. Maggie, go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it would be great if we didn't have to talk about race in America and we could talk about, you know, just us all as human beings. But the reality is that when we look at social science research, we know that across every conceivable measure, when we look at things like, you know, education, healthcare, the criminal justice system, wealth, you know, housing, on and on, we see that there are racial discrepancies and inequalities and that whites do have an advantage, you know, regardless of their class status, they have advantages in our society. And so unfortunately, until we, I think, really confront the reality of racism in America and white supremacy in America, we're not going to be able to get to that place that I think, you know, as you mentioned, or as the caller mentioned, is the ideal of we are all just human beings, but we're not there yet. And so to not talk about patterns in voting or patterns in who gets, you know, pain medication when they go to the hospital for appendicitis, you know, when we don't talk about who gets, you know, mistreated in schools by, you know, along racial lines, we're not actually, you know, addressing the social problem that is before us. And I think that we need to do that.
Maggie, thank you. Really good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Maggie Hagerman's book is called White Kids Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. You can read more about it on the thread. Also want to let you know, because if you heard my thread essay this morning on Morning Edition about the thrillers that come out of Australia, you want the titles? Don't email me. I get an inundation of emails from people going, could you just send me the... I put them up on Twitter. That's the way to find out what I'm reading and what I'm recommending. And I'd love to have you there. It's at Carrie NPR.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828. Or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.